podcast with some quality of life and empowerment discussion. I also want to say one more thank you and goodbye. Thank you to United. My flight's leaving a little earlier than originally anticipated, so I'll have to leave before the end of our program. But thank you so much for everything today. If you have any other questions or there's anything that the MDS Foundation can do for you, please do not hesitate to reach out and ask. Thank you.
Hello, thank you for having me. So we're going to talk about a patient and caregiver guide for living with MDS. So what are our treatment triggers? This is especially important in preventing or delaying progression of MDS to more serious forms of leukemia, such as acute myeloid leukemia. So what are our treatment triggers? Transfusion dependence. Does someone get transfused once a month with some red cells and then all of a sudden their counts drop and they're here three times a week? Progressive or symptomatic cytopenias, meaning are you having recurrent infections because your white blood cells are low? Easy bruising or bleeding because of a low platelet count? Fatigue, needing naps throughout the day? Shortness of breath from a low hemoglobin or weakness? Increasing blasts. This is indicative of disease burden. As your blasts increase in your peripheral blood, we can assume they're increasing in your bone marrow as well. And high-risk disease. Median survival is only about 1 year. Individualized treatment strategy is key. Number one thing we look at is performance status. Good versus poor, fit versus frail. Performance status actually describes a patient's level of functioning in terms of their ability to care for themselves. Daily activity, physical ability. Can they walk into clinic? Is someone wheeling them? Can they dress themselves? Do they need help with their activities of daily living? Comorbidities. Do you have heart disease, kidney disease, lung and liver disease? Next, we look at the revised International Prognostic Scoring System. This rates three factors: percentages of blasts in the marrow, chromosome abnormalities that Dr. Griffiths talked about, and blood counts, degree of cytopenias. Lower risk disease, what we want to do is we want to improve hematopoiesis, the formation and development of blood cells with low risk intensity treatments, such as growth factors or hypomethylating agents such as Vidaza or decitabine. These are given in the outpatient setting and typically have lower risk profiles. Higher risk survival and primary versus secondary MDS. Secondary MDS are those patients who have already been diagnosed with the cancer in the past and have been exposed to chemo and or radiation therapy. Lifestyle, does someone want to play golf? Do they want to, you know, be out shopping and whatnot? Is this going to be an inconvenience to come to our clinic 7 days a week, get transfused three times a week? And just personal choice. So allogeneic bone marrow transplant remains the only potential cure, as Dr. Griffiths had said. It's not an option for many. Age plays a factor. Usually those patients less than 60 years old do well. Comorbidities, again, heart disease, lung disease, and availability of a suitable donor. Patients of a Caucasian race are more likely to find a donor. And does someone have a sibling donor? Age alone should not exclude active therapies. What's most important is that we look at patients' physiological age. This tells us a patient's kidney, liver reserve. So again, we look at performance status. Is someone out jogging 3 miles a day, or are they in bed more than 50% of the day? Comorbidities, and again, fit versus frail. All active therapies for MDS require time to work and will continue indefinitely if they are working. 4 to 6 months of continued treatment is required to evaluate effectiveness. Normally, we don't even repeat a bone marrow until after the end of cycle 4 of therapy. Blood counts often get worse before they get better. We need to plan ahead, set expectations. Some people want to travel to Florida for the winter months. We can do that. We just have to arrange for blood transfusions down in Florida by DASA to be given in their outpatient setting. Proactive management of side effects in the early phases of treatment is key to obtaining the best response. So why is time required? What is really happening? So before treatment begins, blood counts drop as MDS progresses. Normal blood cells are crowded by abnormal stem cells in the bone marrow and blood. So I always try to tell my patients it's kind of like having children at home. They're in your space, they're using your water, your electricity, they're in your way, and they're not paying any bills. So weed them out. When treatment is initiated, treatment cleans the marrow, blood counts may drop further, patients may experience hematologic toxicities. So what are those? Your platelets drop, you have nosebleeds, gum bleeding, neutropenic, you have an infection. As the patient begins to respond, the bone marrow begins to recover, allowing it to make healthy blood cells. Blood cell count should rise and symptoms of MDS should improve. As the response continues, patients can be weaned from supportive care as robust response sets in. So as someone's responding, they may have to come to clinic 3 times a week for blood transfusions, and all of a sudden you see their counts respond. So ideally, they come for 7 days of VIDASA, and you don't see them for 3 weeks in between. The challenge is getting through the first few cycles. Early toxicities may be difficult and are discouraging for the patient. Some of those are nausea, vomiting, loss of appetite, constipation, fatigue. Some people come in and say, oh my God, a truck just ran me over, I don't know what to do. Painful injection sites from VIDASA. There's lots of things we can do to get through all of these symptoms. Key principles of therapy for MDS. Time is required for the best response, a minimum of 4 to 6 months. Cytopenias, meaning low blood counts, often get worse before they get better. Strategies for getting through the initial cycles of therapy. Setting expectations, knowing this is going to be a slow process. I have to hang in there. 90% of the battle is mental. I got this. I can do this. Dose modifications or delays. Your fatigue is profound, so you discuss with Dr. Griffiths, maybe we delay your next cycle by 1 week. We dose reduce your VIDASA. Symptoms become much more tolerable in supportive care. So this is the response chart following 4 cycles of azacitidine. As you can see, you fix the factory and your counts become better. And here's a chart for the patient response over 10 years of lenalidomide therapy. It's sustained moderate but asymptomatic cytopenias, a new normal. So your white count may not be normal from 10 to 14, but it's in a 2 or 3 range, so you have neutrophils to fight infections. So becoming a partner in your care, building your MDS plan, my MDS manager. So tools and strategy for success. Maximize each treatment option. Become a partner in your MDS journey. Caregiver self-care. Those that are taking care of us need to be well. Ask for help. I can't do this alone. Look at your friends, church members. I need rides here or there. Stay well. Build your MDS plan. Explore the building blocks of hope. So there's an app called My MDS Manager. This enables patients to track and store relevant health information between clinician visits. Features an electronic journal, tracks your symptoms, lab results, all in one place. Medical history will constantly ask, did you have a heart attack? Do you have high blood pressure? Some people say, I don't know. It's all in one spot. You don't have to worry about it. Patient education, there it has links to MDS, acute myeloid leukemia right on there, and it helps you track your care team. So if we say to you, you saw a kidney doctor, who was it? When did you see them? It's all right in one spot. What can I do to maximize each treatment option? Understand your disease. Know your IPSS and your revised IPSS score. Learn about your blood counts, hemoglobin, white blood cells, absolute neutrophil count, platelets. Ask for copies of your lab results. When we see our patients, copies of labs are the first thing we hand out because you'll be the expert. You'll say, my hemoglobin's this. It fell this many grams last week. I don't think I can go a whole week without coming in for a transfusion. Take medications as prescribed. If you come in and you say you're having symptoms and we're trying to optimize our medication plan, and then you come back a week later and you say, I'm still having diarrhea. Did you take the Imodium? Did you do this? Did you eat a bland diet? And you say, no, it's kind of like starting at square one again. So we want to maximize that plan. Keep your appointments for visits and for treatments. That's most important when your counts drop. If you need transfusions and your hemoglobin's already a low level and you miss a couple appointments, it's going to be that much lower when you come in and you're going to feel that much more fatigued. Ask about symptoms that need to be reported immediately. If you have no neutrophil count, a fever of 100.4 can be a life-threatening infection. Patients need to get IV antibiotics within 4 hours of that fever. Track your symptoms. I get my Vidaza on this day. I can't move my bowels on this day. It seems to happen every cycle, and then we can be proactive. Ask about the goals and expected duration of treatment. I always tell people, okay, you're starting this Vidaza. It's not a quick fix. It's a slow process. Once we start, we don't stop. It keeps going and going and going. Ask about financial assistance programs. Some of our medications, our prophylaxis medications, are very expensive. The drug companies can offer them for free or get a less expensive drug for you. Best treatment for the patient, shared decision making, can help guide patient and caregivers to include individual preferences, goals, and values. We can tell you this is the best option for you, but you need to help in that plan, because if you don't think it's right, we're not going to be successful. Make the most out of every office visit. Set an agenda for each visit. Ask yourself, what do I want to get out of this visit? Write down the top three things you want to discuss, because we may get sidetracked. You may talk about one symptom, and then we forget about the two other things we really wanted to talk about. Focusing on your agenda will help you make the most of your time. Prepare questions before the visit, because it's always after you leave that you say, oh, I forgot that one thing. Then it might take a while to get that answer. A list of questions in priority order. Start with this list and take it with you the next time you go to the doctor. Bring a member of your personal support team to take notes so you can listen. We actually have patients that come with tape recorders. You have to ask the physician, is it okay to tape this? You do, and then you get to play it back to all your family members. So 10 different people aren't calling and getting 10 different stories. Update your provider on anything that has changed since your last visit. Keep an up-to-date
the
list.
Slide might be one off from your
Thank you. Keep an up-to-date list of prescription and over-the-counter medicines, vitamins, herbs, and supplements you are taking. This is very important because a lot of our drugs do not study the interaction with herbs. We may not want you to take a simple over-the-counter ibuprofen or aspirin because your platelets are low at that point in time. Most of our patients, before they're prescribed a drug, they call and they say, can your pharmacist look at this? Are there any drug-to-drug interactions? Am I allowed to take this? We say yay or nay. If not, we'll come up with something. Make notes on symptoms and side effects you are having. Bring any test results from other healthcare professionals you may see. Cardiologists, they just did an EKG, a stress test. You come here, you tell us, oh, I'm having chest pain. We're going to get an EKG. We have If you bring your data, we can use that information. Eye doctors, dentists, primary care providers. A lot of the times we have to coordinate with dentist visits. We have to transfuse platelets. You may be neutropenic. It might not be a great idea to get a tooth pulled at that time. You may need antibiotics before or after the procedure. And transfusion records. If you go to Florida for the winter months, bring back those transfusion records. Let us know what you needed down there. Once a month, every 3 days. Leave the visit with a clear understanding of the plan. Follow-up appointments and treatment plans. Am I coming back in 1 month? Am I coming back in 2 days? What's the plan? Instructions for taking any new or existing medications. Again, there may be drug-to-drug interactions. Any referrals to other providers. We may want you to see a kidney doctor, cardiologist. Symptoms or problems that should be reported. Again, fever, bleeding. Who to call and where to go. This is extremely important. During business hours, maybe one phone number. After business hours, complete different phone number. Who and how to manage the office and system. We have a patient portal here at Roswell Park. You can email any of your concerns. We have to get back to you within 24 hours. Phone calls. If you call our clinic and you leave a message on a machine, I tell patients, if you don't hear back from us in 2 hours, call again. Don't ever let that get lost in the system. True emergencies, always call 911. Caregivers are an essential member of the healthcare team. They need to focus on their needs too. Maintain a healthy lifestyle, nutrition, exercise, sleep, because if they're run down, they're not going to be a benefit to us. Relaxation or meditation, intimacy or sexual health, spirituality, treatment for depression and anxiety. 90% of the battle is mental. I've seen people actually will themselves to die. Once they give up, it's a downhill trend. Strike a balance each day. Asking for help, be specific. Hey, can you make me a dinner tomorrow? I have to be at the clinic all day, and that would really be a big help. Cooking, cleaning, shopping, yard work, child care, elder care, help with driving. These are all things we can ask caregivers for. So there's an app called Lots of Helping Hands. It's a painless way to organize help. So there's an online calendar. You designate a member to be your community leader. What they do is they coordinate the calendar. It only takes minutes to create. The calendar is flexible. Changes can be made. The coordinator adds names and email addresses of friends and families. It lists needs, again, meals, rides, etc. Someone just to sit with me while I'm at clinic for 8 hours. This all goes on to the group calendar. Friends and family check to see what's needed and sign up to help. The calendar automatically sends reminder emails to those who volunteer, so I can't forget to bring you your dinner. What can I do to stay healthy? Continue to enjoy things you love. Live. This is the point of outpatient therapy. We want it to be a minor inconvenience in your everyday life. Come here, leave, and go do the things you like. Ask for help when needed. Lifestyle, very important. Balanced diet. Sufficient amount of protein, calories. No smoking. Limit of alcohol. We actually have patients who can't drink alcohol because their platelets are low and it increases the risk of bleeding. Increases their liver functions while they're getting chemotherapy. Daily activity. Keep up with your walking a mile a day or whatnot. Because the more you sit, the more you're going to lose. Get enough rest. So patients will come in and tell me, I didn't sleep all night long, but did you sleep all day? Yes. That's why. So simple sleep hygiene. I say don't take a nap for 5 hours and you'll be great tonight. Learn to manage and report your symptoms. I have patients who bleed from their mouth for 7 days. They come in and big blood blisters, and I say, when did this happen? Right when I left clinic 7 days ago. it could have been much, much more easy to take care of. Call us when things happen. No question is a silly question. Exercise, the single most important way to combat fatigue. Ask about a referral to physical therapy or a trainer or develop a tailored program. Any patient that says, I think I may benefit, we send a script off, PT to evaluate and treat. They'll come out if you're not homebound. We send you to an outpatient physical therapy. They'll give you a program. You do that at home. Strength training can even be done in a chair using resistant bands or light weights. 5-pound weights, couple curls, couple times a day. Great. Light cardio, such as walking, will add benefit. Eat light before bed. Avoid reading a backlit device in bed. Dark, quiet, and comfortable sleeping. Help your body relax. Again.
Why do you avoid reading your Kindle in bed?
They just say sometimes the backlight.
Does what?
Again, if you're not sleeping well, talk with your provider, because if you are practicing sleep hygiene and not resting there during the day or at night, that's not good either. There's medications we can use. Nutrition, stay hydrated. I often tell my patients, drink half of your body weight. 180 pounds, drink 90 ounces of water per day. People say, oh, I drank 3 pops and this, that's not staying hydrated. That's actually acting as a diuretic. Balanced diet is key. Protein, vegetables. General nutrition guidelines. Get nutrients from food. Avoid highly processed foods, sugary foods, high fat, and excessive preservatives. So all those things that come in a box, probably not the greatest. Limit or exclude alcohol intake, adequate calories and protein. Avoid fad diets. I had a patient who came in and didn't feel well, and we couldn't figure it out, and he said, oh, I'm trying the starvation diet. You eat one thing in the morning, and you don't eat for 24 hours. I'm not getting chemotherapy, and I'd feel shaky and yucky, too. Ask about any food restrictions, neutropenic diet, most important. Avoid infections. Monitor your blood counts. Know if you're at risk for infection. This way, maybe that week, you don't go to church and sit next to the people sneezing and coughing. Avoid people who are obviously ill. I always tell people, call instead of coming to see them if you're sick. Wash your hands before anyone touches you or after they touch you. Talk with your healthcare team about symptoms that need immediate attention. Again, fever, chills, sweats. Some people get confused. It can be a terrible urinary tract infection, and they have no idea. Immunizations. Keep up with your immunizations. Flu shot every year. Pneumococcal vaccine. Make sure you talk with your doctor, though, because during chemotherapy is probably not the best time. In between cycles. You have to make sure your counts are adequate to get an intramuscular injection as well. How do I avoid bleeding? Your risk of bleeding may increase if your platelet count falls below 50,000. Talk with your healthcare team about recommendations. You may need more frequent count checks instead of once a week, twice a week, just till we get your platelets back up. We tell our patients they cannot use a toothbrush when their platelets fall below 50,000. It has to be soft, or we use toothettes. No flossing of your teeth. We don't use a razor, electric razor, if anything. avoid aspirin or aspirin-containing continuing medications. If you are taking any blood thinner, Coumadin, Xarelto, Eliquis, Plavix, talk with your healthcare provider about whether or not you should modify your medication schedule. I had a patient who said, well, my artery is 70% blocked. And I said, that's okay, because you'll die taking that Plavix from bleeding to death before that ever becomes 100% blocked. You cannot take that when your platelets fall below 50,000. We usually discuss this with the cardiologist so everyone's on board, which is important too. Managing comorbidities. Stay connected with your primary care provider and specialist. I know it feels like you're here every day and you think it's a one-stop shop. Most of the time we can accommodate that, but let's say you're on thyroid medicine. Someone has to monitor those levels every so many weeks or months. They make changes. So seeing your primary care doctor is important. Managing each of your diagnoses is necessary to stay well. Keep a current list of providers, contact information, fax numbers, phone numbers. Share this with each of your providers so they can communicate and collaborate to improve your health. What we do is we carbon copy all of our notes to any physician that you have listed. So if you've changed a primary care physician 3 months ago and we're not aware, they're not getting any of your medical information. Keep us informed. Palliative and supportive care for cancer. The World Health Organization recommends that all patients with a life-threatening illness can benefit from palliative care, now known as supportive care at Roswell Park. The focus of palliative care is to prevent suffering and improve quality of life. Some people say, what do you mean you're sending me to palliative care? I'm not dying, I'm doing well, you just told me to go out and live. But maybe you're constipated every time you get Vidaza, and I've tried certain medicines that aren't working. Supportive care comes in and they use their expertise. They say, melt a pat of butter on a spoon, take that, and you poop every time. So that's what we use them for. Interdisciplinary symptom assessment and management, focused on both the patient and family at all ages and stages of life, is the core of palliative care. Combined terminology, again, palliative and supportive. We present it as supportive now. Again, the MyMDS plan, that app, understand your diagnosis of MDS. The MDS plan provides several tools to allow you to track and manage your journey. You may want to make extra copies of some of these tools before writing them on so that you can continue to track your progress. But this way, when you come to the office, it's all in one place. So the great thing about this app, I went on yesterday to look, some people forget to take their medicines. They may have to take Zofran a half hour before their chemo. It's actually got a reminder on there, and it will alarm and tell you, time to take your Zofran, so there's no reason to forget. It gives you an opportunity to participate in a virtual support network. So when I went on, there was all these patients asking all these different questions and people responding. So it was a live talk, basically. And it gives you live support through the MDS Foundation. This just shows what it looks like. So hope. Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the tune without the words and never stops at all. Emily Dickinson. So patients or caregivers may contact the MDS Foundation. The liaison is Audrey Hasen. Here's her phone number and her email for any questions. Thank you. Sure. There you go.
Shingles.
Dr. Griffiths, shingles vaccine, do you think?
There you go. So in general, if somebody is very neutropenic, we do not recommend that the caregiver get the vaccine. And if people do get the vaccine, then we say that they should wait two weeks before they're hanging around the person who's got the immune defect. This is certainly the case for people getting induction chemotherapy. For people who have more profound and prolonged neutropenia, like people who have chronic MDS with chronic neutropenia, the data is a little bit less clear. So I don't have a firm answer for you. I think I don't have a correct answer. I think the general recommendation is not to is for the patient for sure not to get it, and probably it's safe for the family member, but we don't know. We haven't. I guess what I can say to you is they give a lot of that vaccine, and I have not seen an outbreak of shingles. And most people, particularly the shingles vaccine, is not very well transmitted person to person. So it's probably safe. I can't say 100% it's safe, but it's probably safe. Does that make sense?
I'm hoping it's okay that I just share something for you.
Of course.
The Resource Center at Roswell has a lot of resources for people. So, for instance, if you are having trouble cleaning your house, there is a company that will clean your house for 4 months while you're under your treatment. They also have things about the Live Strong program, with which you can get services at the Y for, I think, 12 weeks, free Y support, you know, access. But a lot of things that I would just encourage you to use. And also, if you're from out of town, they have suggestions for places that you can stay and get the support you need for living arrangements, because you might come from out of state. So I just wanted to offer the Resource Center for everybody, because I volunteer there now and can't tell you what we can do for you.
That's wonderful.
Okay.
Cleaning the house is the big
I can. It's. I don't think it's on.
Oh, it's okay. I don't need it. I have a question regarding depression. I'm dealing with a lot besides this, and I feel like I need an antidepressant, but when I try SSRIs, my platelets drop. So I'm wondering if anybody uses anything natural or has any success with any antidepressants that don't drop your blood counts.
Anybody?
The exercise is very, very effective. And my wife, who has cancer, is the one who likes to exercise. So I had to make a deal. If you hold my hand, I will walk with you. But seriously, my love for her is what gets me to override anything. Romance at Roswell Park.
Does anybody want to share their MDF stories? Because most people, it comes out of nowhere. All of a sudden, they're feeling fatigued, or they go for a pre-op evaluation, and the doctor says, your counts are abnormal, and oh my gosh, you're off to Roswell Park or an oncology center. So if anyone wanted to share their story.
State.
I don't know that it, Dr. Griffiths, vitamin B12, mental state.
As far as depression.
So B12 is an essential building block for the production of and all cells, one of the DNA building blocks, that's the main of the DNA building blocks. And if you have B12 deficiency, people can feel really rotten. B12. Yes, it causes a lot of that. But most of us eat a very diet. B12 is in animal products, eggs,
what gives you to get up and go? When you have to take, what do you do? You have to do take value at 6 or 12 or 13? Or, is there anything to make you more?
Pardon?
We couldn't hear the
question. Okay. Dr. Griffiths, you want to just come up here a second? He's just asking, what can he take for the get up and go? Ritalin, no.
So. Everybody is an individual, and everybody's symptoms are going to be different. I think some people are fatigued because of the effect of the cancer itself. Some people are fatigued directly because of anemia.
Okay.
Some people are fatigued because of depression. I think there's a wide variety of symptoms that present as fatigue, or a wide variety of causes of fatigue. And individually, I think there is no panacea for all. So for some people, increased transfusion supplementation may make people better. For some people, pushing to make the hemoglobin better might make them feel better. For other people, an exercise program. One thing that I do, that I would say again, not to tout exercise as the be all and end all, but for any degree of anemia, your physical reserve to tolerate that degree of anemia depends on your level of activity. So the less active you are and the less used to the level of hemoglobin that you have, the more likely you are to be fatigued. And so I think it is really important to maintain functional activity, and that means walking. I mean, I don't expect everybody to get on, you know, the treadmill and run 6 miles, but I do ask my patients to go for a walk on a regular basis. And when I say that, I mean 30 minutes of walking if you can, 3 days a week or more, because if you can do that, you can push yourself. You actually improve your physical reserve, and you'll tolerate whatever degree of anemia you have to a much better extent. I also think that by exercising and moving, people feel better. You know, humanity was not intended, evolutionarily, we were supposed to be out walking around all day, right? We're not supposed to be sitting around facing our computers and watching television. So I think all of us do better if we move.
And
so
the energy drinks they got out on the market, they help you or not?
So those are all high-dose caffeine and vitamin, high-dose B vitamins. I personally would not recommend them. I see a lot of people who do those and who show up to my clinic with atrial fibrillation from too much caffeine. And I mean, when I say a lot, I've had at least 2 people do that. So that always puts me off a little bit. Also, if I take too much caffeine, it always makes me feel unwell. So that's not my recommendation.
Can exercise actually raise your red blood count and hemoglobin? And when you exercise, you say,
So I would suggest, yeah, so definitely, certainly. And I, again, 30 minutes is not the all and end all. I think I would recommend people go for as much of a walk as they can tolerate. And just the fact of moving will make you feel better. Does exercise raise your hemoglobin? I don't think so necessarily, but I do. There are some data in mice that have an MDS-like syndrome that by exercising you can mobilize some of your stem cells from the blood, and that by doing that the ones that are less fit get killed off. Although that has not been proven, and the repeat experiments that show my colleague who did some experiments to try and recapitulate that mouse data was not able to prove that it was true. Okay. There's, in theory, some theoretical ideas about that. But what exercise will do is it will train your system, your heart, your lungs, everything about you, your muscles, to function better for the degree of hemoglobin, right? So I can give you a personal example. My little sister, for all of her life, decided that she wanted to be a vegetarian. She started this at the age of 6, and she was a vegetarian for all that time, and she does not like to eat eggs, and she doesn't like to take her vitamins. And so one day she called me, and she said, "Elizabeth, my sister's a long distance runner. I should preface this by saying that she runs marathons on a regular basis." She called me and she said, "I'm so worried. I can't run for more than 2 minutes." And so we sent her into the emergency room, and her hemoglobin was 5. And it turned out that she had a very profound iron deficiency. Okay, but she was living on the third floor walk up in Rome, and she was walking all day every day with her hemoglobin of 5 grams. And they said to her, "Oh my God, how can you possibly do this?" But she was running still, running and walking, still 4 or 5 miles every day with a hemoglobin of 5 grams. And I think the point here is that she was very well compensated for her degree of anemia, right? And she was very physically well. And so depending on how fit you are and how used to your level of anemia you are, you can tolerate much more. And so it's a point of fitness. And so if you maintain your fitness, if you keep walking and keep pushing yourself, your body will get used to the lower hemoglobin and you'll feel better even if we don't change your hemoglobin, right? And so to the extent that it's possible, and I don't expect you to get up on, I don't want you to come to spinning class with me every morning, okay? You don't have to spin for 40 minutes and push your heart rate as high as it'll go, but a little bit will make you feel better. That's just, in my opinion, that's just common sense.
Sure. Just keep that, Dr. Griffiths.
Quick question. In the state of New York, my oncologist will give me Procrit if my hemoglobin is 10. In the state of Florida, the oncologist will give me Procrit if it's 11.5 and below. Why is there a difference like that?
So the package insert for management of hemoglobin using Procrit or erythropoietin-stimulating agents in cancer in general does not allow you to give it for example, if you have cancer and you're getting Procrit, if your hemoglobin is above 10 for a regular cancer. Okay, if you look at the package insert specifically around the diagnosis of myelodysplasia, it's acceptable to give for a hemoglobin below 11. Okay, and that is because in solid tumors, in the solid tumor literature, and in renal and in patients with renal failure who also get treated with that drug, they have seen an increased risk of cardiovascular death if you push the hemoglobin above 10. Okay, and so if you have other cancers and your doctor is an oncologist who treats mostly other solid tumors, they probably are uncomfortable pushing your hemoglobin above 10. Whereas if your doctor in Florida is more a hematologist and is more used to treating patients with MDS. Okay, so that's probably the distinction. And it's based on the risk. It's based on the risk of heart attacks and strokes and clots that can happen in patients with kidney dysfunction, people who are on dialysis who get Procrit, because I told you that EPO is made in the kidney. It's a copy of the kidney hormone. So people who have end-stage renal disease who are on dialysis, they often need supplementation. And in solid tumors where the risk of blood clots is often higher, right? Because the cancers secrete hormones that increase clotting.
Thank you. Yes.
That's okay, I don't need that. Thanks. David here was diagnosed about 18 months ago with MDS as a result of just some routine blood work. I'd be curious if anyone would share how long you've been living with MDS. You know, here's a year and a half, but do we have like 10 years or?
Did you hear that, Dr. Griffiths?
I did.
Okay.
So we don't have as much data for CMML just because it's a smaller patient population. Patients with CMML1, that's to say a lower blast percentage, seem to live longer than patients with CMML2. There are some mutations with CMML that are associated with a higher risk of progression, we think. Many people, especially if the patient is very young, we all worry about CMML being a potentially a worse actor than low-grade MDS, okay? And so many physicians would keep a close eye on somebody with CMML to make sure that they're not developing CMML2 or accelerating, because some of the mutations associated with CMML are associated with a more proliferative phenotype. Does that answer your question?
I was diagnosed 2.5 years ago, only through a routine blood test with a new doctor because I was retired. So I was wondering what, if there's a percentage of people like that gentleman up there and myself who were diagnosed just because they had no symptoms.
When someone's neutrophil falls below 0.5, we institute a neutropenic diet. Dr. Griffiths is not as stringent with her patients, but we definitely say, like, avoid berries. Those things can have fungus on them. Fresh fruit, someone should be washing the fruit, peeling it for you. Stay away from salad bars. You don't know how long that food sits out. Avoid cold cuts just because they can have bacteria. Cooking things is always better than leftovers. Things like that.
Okay, can I just make a comment here? Okay, so the data for neutropenic diets are derived, okay, they come, the idea that this is a bad thing to eat fresh fruits and veg and all that stuff comes from early data in patients getting bone marrow transplant and patients getting chemotherapy, high-dose chemotherapy. For patients with MDS, the risk is probably less, and it is my view that eliminating all salad from your diet is very unpleasant. Okay, so it is my recommendation to my patients, and again, the practice varies quite widely. I know that there's some people here from out of town, and maybe, I don't know if Hopkins is doing this. When I was a fellow at Hopkins, and I trained extensively, I was at Hopkins for 8 years, you know, we did not institute a neutropenic diet, but we did say we want people to wash their fruits and veg, and we want them to peel things. And what I say to my patients is berries very frequently have mold growing in the exterior, right? So if you leave your berries, if you look at your berries, and even if you get it fresh from the grocery store, if you open that up, there's often mold in there, okay? And the number one problem for my patients who are neutropenic, especially patients with MDS who are neutropenic for a long time, is the development of mold infections in the lung. Now, we live in a soup of mold. Mold is in everything. It's in the soil, okay? It's in, on all the fruits and veg and everything. And molds live with us, and most of them are fine. But if your immune system is compromised, you may grow mold, just like the bread that you leave on the counter can grow mold, right? And mold is an organism that's a little bit more complicated than bacteria, and it's a little bit more like us as human beings in terms of its genetic complement and its behavior. And so it's a bit more challenging to treat. And so the antibiotics and antifungals that we use for mold prophylaxis tend to be a little bit less well-tolerated, tend to be a little bit less pleasant to take. The usual prophylaxis that we use for people who have prolonged periods of neutropenia are one of the azole antifungals. The three medications that are in this family are voriconazole, posaconazole, and isavuconazole. And for patients who are profoundly neutropenic for long periods of time, we often will use those as preventive. But again, I don't think it's reasonable to ask people to stop eating salad for the next 10 years of their life if all goes well, you know. So I just say wash it, be thoughtful. If it's rotten, don't eat it. Don't eat on salad bars, and try to avoid, you know, old cold cuts that have been sitting around for a long time. Fair enough? Again, common sense.
There's a question there.
My hemoglobin count started dropping very, very gradually a number of years ago. I'm saying like 10 or 12 years ago. And I was on methotrexate. And I was taken off of methotrexate, but it still continues to just drop very, very slowly. And I wonder, I don't think, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think MDS is you get it overnight. I think it was a very gradual process. So to say when I guess I've been starting to go to smarter and smarter doctors because now I'm diagnosed with MDS, but I think maybe I had the beginning of it that many years ago because I've been off of methotrexate now for probably 10 years at least, and it still just continues to drop very, very slowly. And so it's not an overnight process, is it? It's just, so to say I've had it for 4 years, I've had the diagnosis for 4 years, mm-hmm. but I have no clue how long I actually have had it and how far I am in the process.
That's exactly my feeling about this disease. Okay, so I when I describe it, people who've seen me in clinic, I sometimes tell them. People ask me, "Is this leukemia? What is this?" And I say, "This is kind of a cockroachy problem, right? It's probably there. It's probably been there for a long time. It slowly accumulates over time. That's why I said, you know, when we start to see the bone marrow blasts increasing, when the blasts increase over time, usually with this disease." At some point, if you lived long enough, maybe it would increase and it would get to above 20%, and then we would call it AML. But there, I would argue that there's a distinct clinical entity of acute myeloid leukemia that presents today that was not present a month ago, 2 months ago, 3 months ago. And that is a distinct thing from people who have mildly low blood counts for a long time, who then develop more profound blood counts, more profound low blood counts, and then have an increased blast percentage in the marrow, maybe 19, maybe 20%. That's, I think, a different disease. I think that's a different disease entity, and we need to think about it differently, right? Because if you have an MDS-associated AML, and you had an MDS diagnosis 6 months ago or a year ago, and all of a sudden now you have 20% blasts, the pathophysiology of that process, the underlying mutational spectrum, the underlying behavior of the disease is, in my view, quite distinct from somebody who had nothing, right, 6 months ago, and now has acute leukemia. Even though when you look under the microscope, the absolute blast percentage for those two people might be the same. Does that make sense to everyone? So if I have a cockroachy kind of disease, it might not be the case that high-dose chemotherapy, which is designed essentially like napalm to kill everything that's growing quickly, right, might not be quite as effective. And that's indeed what we see in patients with MDS or AML out of an MDS diagnosis who get napalm-like chemotherapy. Now, all the chemo that we give, right, the high-dose chemotherapies that we give, those are all DNA toxins. And they capitalize on the difference in terms of turnover time between the cancer and the normals. Does that make sense? So cytarabine and daunorubicin, what they do is they poison DNA replication. They poison the ability of your cells in your body to copy mother to daughter strand of DNA. Does that make sense to everyone? So they poison the ability to copy your chromosomes. If the disease you have is a relatively slower growing disease that took a year to go from a blast percentage of 10% to a blast percentage of 20%, the approach with high-dose chemo might not be as effective as it would be for someone who went from nothing a month ago to 80% blasts today. Does that make sense? So it is my view that our thinking about the distinction between MDS and AML has to evolve from thinking about it as a disease that is defined by the blast percentage today to defining it based on the mutational profile. And indeed, what we find is that specifically patients respond differently to chemotherapy based on their mutational profile. If you see mutations that are similar to the MDS background, those people respond less well to aggressive chemotherapy regimens and better to drugs like Vidaza or azacitidine and decitabine, and maybe to different thinking, right? To different approaches. And so I think from my perspective, it's important to understand conceptually that these are two distinct entities and they have distinct clinical outcomes and distinct responses to therapy. And so I always tell people, from my perspective, MDS is a cockroach, right? It's hanging out in there, it's not dividing too quickly, it's really a pain. It's probably been there for many years, right? And so thinking that you're gonna be able to wipe it out by taking a quick shot or just burning everything is not a logical approach. So I think it's a little bit like asking a question about when you took the picture in time, right? So if I do a bone marrow today and you don't have dysplasia but you're a little bit anemic and I look and I find a mutation and that mutation represents 15 or 10% of the total cells in there, that mutated cell may be secreting some hormone that's impeding the normal production of cells. We don't know for sure, but we think maybe that's what's going on. And then I do another bone marrow in 2 years or 4 years, and now I see some dysplasia, and if I look at the allelic ratio, maybe that allelic ratio is now 20 or 30%. I think it's a little bit like gerrymandering election, like voting, right? So where do you want to put that line? If we take that all the way to the end, you could imagine, have you guys all seen the film Gattaca? You remember this old movie dystopian future. No, many years ago. Too old. You guys are not watching the movie. So in that movie, the idea is that we are molecularly profiling everybody's genome at the time that they're born, and we're treating them for their future history of heart disease when they get born, right? And so we start treating them before, and then the end point of that is engineered kids where we weed out all of these potential risks for developing problems. Now, we're not there, but I think it's, that question is a little bit like what you're saying. If you have a problem that might present itself in the future, I don't want to start treating you today unless I have a treatment that's going to change the natural history of what you have. And it doesn't really matter if I call it today or tomorrow. We call that ascertainment bias in the field. We say, we found it earlier, but it didn't change the survival, right? So if it looks like you're living longer when I make that decision, when I find it earlier, it looks like you're living longer, but I just didn't find it until later, and then you're living a shorter time, but that doesn't change the natural history. Does that make sense to everybody? Okay? And so I think that's a little bit what we're talking about here. Okay, we can call it MDS earlier. It makes us all worried, because then we get online and we read about MDS and we see that the outcome for MDS patients, median survival for high-risk MDS is 6 months, okay? So if we do that, we scare ourselves. Then we spend a lot of time being worried. And then the quality of our life, which is what all of this is all about, is impeded and is not good. So I think it's important to take all of this with a bit of a grain of salt, right? Every single one of us, all we've got is today, okay? You wake up in the morning, you have your coffee in the morning, do your crossword puzzle with the people you love. That is what life is about. And we could all get killed off by a nuclear holocaust tomorrow, or the sun could explode. But unless we enjoy today, there's no point, right? And that's true for every single one of us. And so I think it's very, very important to kind of think about the disease and think about outcomes and make plans, but also to live every day. And again, this is my personal philosophy. I'm bending all your ears about it.
I think my lab report said that I had trisomy 8. Is that correct? Would that be the correct term? Trisomy 8?
And it's three copies of chromosome
8. Yeah. And it's also fairly common with MDS.
Yes, that is correct.
Is there anything that makes it worse? Or does it not matter? Is it a kind of mutation that is, it'd be better not to have it?
So do you remember back when I presented the slides using the cytogenetic profiles from more than 2,000 patients with MDS who received no disease-modifying therapy? They were able to make predictions about survival based on the presence or absence of cytogenetic abnormalities. Do you guys remember that slide? Okay. So I cannot speak to individuals. Trisomy 8 is a frequently, many of these mutations are relatively frequently identified in patients with MDS. So we know that trisomy 8 occurs in AML and MDS. It's considered an intermediate risk, cytogenetic risk classification. Many of the cytogenetic risk classifications are considered intermediate, right? That means we don't really know. Sometimes it's associated with the indolent outcome. Sometimes it's associated with more aggressive outcome. For individual people who have individual problems, then who have individual experiences of their MDS, each person is distinct. I don't know if that answered your question, but
I'm not sure if we have any other questions, but I think we will be moving on shortly to the next presentation. Is there anybody else that has anything they'd like to ask or share before we turn things over? Yes, I believe, it's on iron overload, I believe. Yeah. This is the end of this. Yep. You're just a minute, please. We got someone who'd like to say something.
Buffalo, are people interested, and how do we go about doing I believe, and I'm stepping in for my colleagues from the U.S. I'm from Canada, and do what they do in Canada. But I do know that they do have support groups. So I'm thinking if there's a way that you wanted to get it started would be to contact the MDS Foundation. You could probably contact Audrey, and they may help you facilitate that. Because, you know, as you say, I think so much of the battle is spending a day like this, talking to other people. You know, the question up here from the gentleman that was just diagnosed 18 months ago, to see somebody 5 years later who, you know, is still doing well. You know, I encourage all of you to reach out that way. And if not in person, there's a lot of, you know, online support. And I know the MDS Foundation do a wonderful job of connecting people. So really encourage you to do that.
Hi.
So the next portion is a talk on iron overload that's sponsored by Novartis. It's not officially part of the